This program is provided by lawyer Kyung Jin Kim.
Imagine a man stepping out into the sweltering, really humid heat of a Taiwanese night market.
Oh, yeah, the air is just incredibly thick.
Exactly. Crowds are totally elbow to elbow. The neon signs are buzzing right overhead. Now hold that image and picture that exact same man standing under the harsh, you know, incredibly clinical lights of a Silicon Valley tech stage.
Presenting a keynote to thousands of industry veterans.
Right. And in every single scenario, regardless of the weather or the stakes, he's wearing the exact same piece of clothing, a signature black leather jacket.
This is a very deliberate choice, too. I mean, you look at the history of Silicon Valley CEOs, and their wardrobes usually signal something about their core philosophy.
Yeah, like Steve Jobs with the black turtleneck.
Right, to signal minimalist aesthetics and simplicity. Or Mark Zuckerberg wearing the hoodie to project that whole hacker culture vibe. But this leather jacket, it operates on an entirely different symbolic level.
And that symbolism is exactly what we are unpacking today. For you listening, we are pulling from a really fascinating new book chapter that breaks down what the author calls the philosophy of the black leather jacket.
We are, of course, talking about Jensen Huang.
Yes, the CEO of NVIDIA, a man who is often referred to as the Caesar of Silicon Valley. And just to be clear, this deep dive is not your standard dry business biography.
No, we're not detailing quarterly earnings or stock splits today.
Exactly. We are looking at a wild, ruthlessly logical survival philosophy that basically takes traditional business school management theory and completely dismantles it.
Which is pretty necessary when you are trying to understand a company that has reached a multi-trillion dollar valuation. I mean, the premise of our source material is that the jacket is not just some quirky fashion statement. It is armor.
Armor, like a Roman legionnaire's battle uniform.
Exactly like that. Huang wears it as a daily physical reminder that he's a commander who must always be ready for the front lines.
Right. He views his role not as a king sitting in a palace somewhere, but as a soldier down in the mud with his troops.
Yeah, and what is most compelling here is that this obsession with the front lines, it isn't just a motivational metaphor. It is the literal architectural blueprint for how he runs an organization of tens of thousands of people.
Let's actually look at that architecture because, I mean, this is where my brain completely stalled out when I was reviewing our sources.
It's definitely jarring.
Right. Because traditional management theory, the kind of universally accepted framework you find in any normal corporate structure, it dictates that a single leader should really only have somewhere between 6 to 10 direct reports.
Yeah, any more than that. And the theory goes that the leader becomes a bottleneck.
Right. Mentorship breaks down, efficiency drops, and the whole system just devolves into chaos.
It's the standard corporate pyramid. You build a hierarchy to filter information and, you know, delegate responsibility.
Right. But Jensen Huang has 60. 6-0. 60 direct reports. Vice presidents, core engineers, project leads. They all just bypass the middle management layers and report directly to him.
Which is wild.
And to compound that structural anomaly, he doesn't even have a fixed corner office.
Wait, no office at all?
No. He literally roams the halls of NVIDIA headquarters, just camping out in random conference rooms.
Uh-huh.
Or he'll just sit right next to new hires in the cafeteria.
So he is basically a CEO without a desk, managing an impossibly wide executive team.
Exactly. Now, on paper, that looks like a complete recipe for administrative collapse.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
But to understand the logic behind it, we have to look at what Huang actively fears most in a business, which is information distortion.
Right.
Think about how a traditional corporate hierarchy operates when a crisis hits. An engineer on the ground spots a critical flaw in a new design.
Like a major technical issue.
Exactly. So they report it to their team leader. Now, the team leader, wanting to protect their unit's reputation, they soften the bad news slightly before passing it up to the department head.
Naturally, yeah.
Then the department head puts a strategic positive spin on it and briefs the vice president.
So by the time that message finally reaches the CEO's desk, an urgent multi-million dollar engineering crisis has basically been polished into like a minor scheduling delay.
Right. And the danger there isn't just a delay, it's multi-million dollar engineering drift. Huang uses this analogy of a messenger crossing a vast mountain range to deliver news of a war.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah, with every mountain crossed, with every layer of management the message passes through, the reality of the battlefield gets diluted by human bias and, well, self-preservation.
So he flat out refuses to accept polished reports.
Exactly. He flattened his empire because he wants the raw, unvarnished, often bloody reality of the front line.
He wants the entire company operating as a single, connected human brain.
Yeah, to the point where he actually dislikes using terms like departments or divisions.
Because they imply separation from the whole.
Right, exactly.
Okay, wait, I have to stop you there and push back on the actual mechanics of this because the math simply does not work.
Fair enough.
If you are listening, just imagine your own email inbox right now. Now imagine 60 highly driven, high-level executives needing your final approval, your strategic coaching, your dedicated time.
It sounds overwhelming.
Right. If Huang is requiring each of his 60 commanders to send him their top five priorities every single morning, which our sources say he does, that is 300 high-level data points.
300, yeah.
How does a human brain process 300 executive bullet points before breakfast without becoming the exact bottleneck he is trying to avoid? Doesn't a 60-person reporting structure just create an unmanageable, chaotic group chat?
Well, you're assuming he manages them the way a traditional boss manages a subordinate.
With one-on-ones, career coaching, isolated strategy sessions, that sort of thing.
Right. But the secret to this mechanism is that Huang does not do one-on-ones. Ever.
Wait, really? He has 60 direct reports and holds zero private meetings with them.
None. Zero. The mechanism that makes this actually work is radical public transparency.
Okay, unpack that for me.
He doesn't read those 300 bullet points to micromanage individual tasks. He reads them as a diagnostic tool to see the shape of the entire network. He is looking for systemic patterns.
So he's looking at the big picture.
Exactly. If he spots an issue or needs to steer a strategy, he doesn't pull one executive into a closed-door meeting. He addresses it to all of them simultaneously.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, he fundamentally believes that the moment you close a door and share strategic information with only a select few, you have just invented office politics.
Because in a traditional setup, being in the room where it happens is a form of currency. When only three people know the secret strategy, they suddenly have power over the other 57.
Precisely. Fiefdoms start to form, and executives start optimizing for their own departmental survival rather than the company's actual success.
That makes so much sense.
By making all feedback and direction completely public, Huang basically destroys the currency of office politics. Information ceases to be a tool for leverage.
It just becomes the raw material that everyone shares to solve the math problem together.
Right. He trusts that his 60 direct reports are already experts. They don't need him to teach them how to code or, you know, build supply chains.
They just need him to act as the central router.
Exactly. Taking all those sensory inputs, synthesizing the landscape, and broadcasting the reality back to the entire network so they can all pivot as one unit.
That reframes it completely. He's not managing 60 individuals. He's managing the environment they operate in.
Yes, the environment itself.
But let's take that to its logical conclusion. If you have an environment where 60 leaders are openly sharing raw, unfiltered data every single day, and there are absolutely no closed doors to hide behind,
you are going to see a massive amount of failure.
Right. Happening in real time, completely out in the open.
It guarantees that every misstep is highly visible.
Which brings us to how a leader actually handles those public failures, because that is the ultimate stress test of this flat structure.
Oh, definitely.
Our sources highlight this incredible story from the early 2000s involving a leaf blower.
It is arguably the defining case study of NVIDIA's internal culture.
So NVIDIA had just released a highly anticipated new graphics card, but it shipped with a fatal flaw. The cooling fan attached to the processor was unbelievably loud.
Like noticeably, disruptively loud.
Not just a low hum, disruptive to the point of ruining the user experience. Now, in the standard corporate playbook, the executives responsible for signing off on that thermal design would be quietly pulled into an office.
Reprimanded, probably fired.
Right, and the PR department would just bury the issue to protect the stock price.
Because the instinct is always to hide the failure and isolate the individuals responsible so the rest of the company doesn't lose confidence.
Exactly. But Huang took the exact opposite approach. He didn't fire the engineering leads. Instead, he required the team responsible for this loud graphics card to stand up in front of hundreds of their fellow employees. Yeah, and he made them walk through a detailed step-by-step autopsy of every single bad assumption, every ignored warning sign, and every flawed metric that resulted in that loud fan.
And then, to cap it off, NVIDIA's own marketing team released a parody video to the tech press.
Starring those same engineers.
Using their failed, noisy graphics card as a literal leaf blower in a yard.
It is an absolute masterclass in corporate theater, but I mean, it usually triggers a very specific reaction from people hearing it for the first time.
And what's your reaction?
My reaction is that standing in front of hundreds of brilliant colleagues to present my absolute worst professional failure and then being parodied in a video sounds like a literal psychological nightmare.
It sounds rough, yeah.
How is that not just institutionalized public shaming? I would think that would destroy morale and make everyone absolutely terrified to ever take a risk.
It certainly sounds like a public execution if you view it through the lens of ego. But Huang frames the mechanism of failure completely differently. To him, this isn't shaming. It is maximizing the return on investment of a mistake. Think about it. If NVIDIA just paid millions of dollars in lost revenue and development costs because of a thermal design error, why should only the three people in that room get to learn the lesson?
Oh, I see.
The mistake is the tuition fee. The company has already paid it, so the company better extract every ounce of educational value from it by teaching everyone else exactly where the landmines are hidden.
So by forcing the failure into the sunlight, he's actually desensitizing the organization to the stigma of being wrong.
Exactly. He is decoupling failure from survival. And this actually stems from his own deeply personal context.
Right, his early career.
Early on, NVIDIA was literally 30 days away from bankruptcy. He knows what actual existential ruin looks like. He understands that trying something new and failing is just feedback.
But hiding that failure because you are embarrassed,
that will kill the company. When an engineer sees a team survive the leaf blower presentation without being fired, it creates profound psychological safety.
The underlying message being, if you push the boundaries of physics and fall flat on your face, the CEO isn't going to fire you.
Right. He is going to study your fall and teach the rest of us so we don't trip over the exact same wire.
And he backs up that psychological safety with actual financial security, right? Our sources note that he personally reviews the compensation structure for all 42,000 employees.
Yes, that's him.
He actively ensures his teams are highly compensated, basically creating countless millionaires within the engineering ranks. He wants to take their basic everyday survival anxiety off the table.
So they can focus entirely on the creative, impossible math problems right in front of them. That financial security is the bedrock.
Because you can't ask someone to be that vulnerable if they're worried about rent.
You cannot ask an employee to endure the grueling, transparent theater of failure if they are constantly worried about missing a mortgage payment or being laid off. When the financial anxiety is gone, the only thing left to protect is the ego.
And to survive in that environment without your ego shattering, it requires a very specific type of mental conditioning. Our sources indicate Huang actually has a dedicated term for this armor. He calls it intellectual honesty.
It sounds like a polite corporate buzzword, honestly.
It does.
But in practice, intellectual honesty is a brutal, unforgiving discipline. The best way to understand its mechanics is to look at the Sega story from the mid-90s.
This story is wild. So NVIDIA is still a very young, very vulnerable company at this point, and they managed to land a massive make-or-break contract to build a graphics chip for the gaming console giant Sega.
A huge deal for them.
Huge. The chip architecture is called the NV1, but deep into the development cycle, Huang realizes they have made a catastrophic technical bet.
Right, because the industry was at a crossroads regarding how to render 3D graphics. NVIDIA had bet heavily on a technique called quadratic texture mapping.
Which is essentially trying to draw graphics using curved surfaces.
It's exactly. But the rest of the industry, including Microsoft with their new DirectX platform, was moving decisively toward rendering graphics using triangles or polygons.
So the technical realization was stark. The NV1 architecture wasn't just slightly behind schedule, it was fundamentally incompatible with the future of the entire software ecosystem.
If they continued building it, the chip would be obsolete on arrival.
And Sega's new console would just fail. Now keep in mind, NVIDIA is effectively out of money at this point.
This Sega contract is their sole lifeline.
Right. Yet Huang flies to Japan, sits across from the CEO of Sega, and basically says, "We are technically wrong. Our architecture is a dead end. You need to fire us immediately and find a new partner, or your console is doomed."
Most executives would have tried to patch the problem.
Or hide the severity of the flaw, right?
Yeah, or convince the client to stick it out just to keep the revenue flowing.
It's the ultimate rejection of the sunk cost fallacy. It is literally like sitting at a high-stakes poker table, realizing you have an absolutely terrible hand, folding, showing everyone at the table your offer cards, and then politely asking the dealer if you can just keep the pot anyway.
Which is crazy.
Because that is the second half of the story. After admitting total failure, Huang asks Sega for the final contract payment anyway.
You might call it audacity, but Huang would just call it cold mathematics and pure intellectual honesty. He told the Sega CEO the unvarnished truth about the technology.
But he also told the truth about his own survival.
Right. He said, if you don't pay us the final milestone payment anyway, my company will go bankrupt.
Wow.
The sunk cost fallacy makes humans lie to themselves to protect their egos and their past investments. Huang refused to lie. And the astonishing part is that the CEO of Sega, who was just disarmed by this incredibly rare display of brutal honesty, agreed.
He actually agreed.
He canceled the contract, but authorized the final payment. That money kept NVIDIA alive just long enough to pivot to Polygon-based graphics, build the Ryvie 128 chip, and basically save the company.
That Sega story is a brilliant example of intellectual honesty when you are literally starving. But the true test of a philosophy isn't when your back is against the wall. It's when you are rich, successful, and have a massive ego to protect.
Oh, definitely.
Which brings us to the smartphone boom and the story of the Tegra mobile chip.
This is where we see the transition from mere survival to global dominance. So, years later, smartphones are exploding onto the market. It is the obvious next frontier.
Naturally.
NVIDIA pours massive amounts of capital, time, and engineering resources into developing the Tegra processor specifically for mobile phones. They are fighting for market share against giants like Qualcomm and Samsung.
But they find themselves stuck in this grinding war of attrition over commodity hardware.
Right. A standard CEO, looking at the billions invested and the internal momentum behind the mobile division, would have just doubled down.
Slashed prices, poured money into marketing.
Fought to the bitter end just to justify the initial investment and save face with Wall Street.
But instead of doubling down, Huang applies what he calls first principles thinking, which is, you know, another one of those phrases that gets thrown around. But the mechanics of how he used it here are fascinating. He didn't ask how they could beat Qualcomm's pricing.
He stripped the problem down to its fundamental physics.
Exactly.
He asked a brutal question. Does the mobile phone market fundamentally require our core capability? NVIDIA's unique advantage was complex graphics rendering and parallel processing.
Doing a lot of complex math all at once.
Right. He realized that smartphones were becoming basic commodity devices that didn't actually need that level of specialized parallel processing power to function well. Mobile phones were not their true battlefield.
So, relying on that intellectual honesty, he stands in front of his entire company, looks at this massive, incredibly expensive mobile chip division, and simply says, we cannot win here. We are walking away.
He just abandoned the entire mobile market.
He absorbs the blow to his ego and the massive hit to the stock price, because first principles thinking led him to a completely different conclusion.
And while everyone else was obsessing over smartphones, researchers in academia were beginning to experiment with neural networks.
Early AI.
Yeah, and they had a massive problem. Neural networks required training on enormous data sets, and traditional computer processors were way too slow because they handled tasks sequentially.
One by one. But NVIDIA's graphics cards process thousands of pixels simultaneously.
Yes. That parallel processing capability was the exact mathematical key required to train artificial intelligence.
Wow.
The realization was profound. AI wasn't an uncharted territory. Researchers knew what they wanted to do. But applying GPU parallel processing to neural networks was the revolutionary leap.
So Huang saw that AI, unlike mobile phones, fundamentally required the specialized physics that only NVIDIA could provide.
Exactly. So he pivoted the entire massive ship of his company away from the safety of the mobile phone wars and directed every ounce of their engineering power toward AI hardware.
Which is incredible to think about.
Yeah.
If he had allowed his ego to trap him in the sunk cost fallacy of the Tegra mobile chip fighting Samsung over pennies, the multi-trillion dollar AI infrastructure that powers the modern world simply wouldn't exist as we know it today.
His philosophy dictates that the role of a leader is not to always be right. The role of a leader is to help the organization find the truth as quickly as possible.
Even if it hurts.
Exactly. Sometimes finding the truth requires standing in front of 50,000 employees and admitting that a multi-billion dollar strategy was wrong, just so you can change course before you hit the iceberg.
Which brings us all the way back to the opening image, that black leather jacket. It isn't a branding exercise or a piece of tech bro vanity.
No, it is a daily physical safeguard against complacency. Even now, approaching 70 years old and sitting at the helm of one of the most valuable companies in human history, he wakes up every morning with what he describes as a healthy anxiety.
A healthy anxiety.
He still operates with the visceral memory that his company could go bankrupt in 30 days. The jacket means he is still on the front lines.
It's the armor of a man who still carries the operational humility of someone washing dishes at a Denny's, which is literally where he started. He doesn't approach his 60 top commanders every morning with a rigid list of undeniable orders.
No, he approaches them with an open invitation. He looks at the raw data, destroys the silos, and simply asks, "What do you think?"
Because when you systematically remove the corporate hierarchy, eliminate the fear of public failure, and abandon the sunk cost of your own ego, the only thing left in the room is the truth.
And organizations that operate on the truth just move faster than everyone else.
Which leaves us with a final thought for you, the listener. Think about your own life right now. Think about a project at work, a strategic direction, or even a deeply held personal belief that you are holding on to right now out of pure stubbornness or pride.
We all have them.
You know deep down the mechanics aren't working, but you've already invested so much time and emotional energy into it. What would happen if you practiced radical intellectual honesty today?
Just drop the ego.
What if you bypassed your own internal PR department, admitted you took a wrong turn, and openly asked for help? How much faster could you abandon a losing battle and find your true battlefield? Something to think about the next time you put on a jacket. Until next time, keep digging deep.
This program is provided by Lawyer Kyungjin Kim.